This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Space Case by Stuart Gibbs. Read by Gibson Fraser.
Excerpt from the Official Residence Guide to Moonbase Alpha. Copyright 2040 by National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
Welcome to Moonbase Alpha. Congratulations on your selection as a resident of the first permanent extraterrestrial human habitat. To ease your transition from Earth, Moonbase Alpha, referred to from here on as MBA, has been designed to feel as comfortable and familiar as any residence on our home planet. Our engineers and designers have spared no expense to provide all MBA residents, or lunar knots, with everything they need for a relaxing, pleasurable existence. However, life on the moon will not be without challenges. There are obviously many differences between this residence and one on Earth, many of which you may be pleasantly surprised by. To that end, please take the necessary time to read this helpful, informative manual in its entirety, as it will likely answer any questions you have about your new home, and perhaps a few questions you hadn't even thought to ask yet. Once again, congratulations on your selection. Welcome to the moon. Enjoy your new home.
Chapter 1. Evil Plumbing. Earth Year, 2041. Lunar Day, 188. Smack in the middle of the night. Let's get something straight right off the bat. Everything the movies have ever taught you about space travel is garbage. Giant spacecraft that are as comfortable as floating cruise ships? Complete fantasy. Warp speed travel? Never gonna happen. Holodecks? Terraforming? Beaming up? Don't count on any of it. Life in outer space sucks. Trust me, I know. My name is Dashiell Gibson. I'm 12 years old, and I live on the moon. On Moonbase Alpha, to be exact. You know this, of course. Everyone on Earth knows this, unless they've been living in the Amazon rainforest for the last few years. And since there's barely anything left of the Amazon rainforest, I'm guessing that's unlikely. Moonbase Alpha, along with everyone who lives on it, has been the subject of an absolutely staggering amount of hype. The first human outpost in space. The first people to live on a celestial body besides Earth. A glorious first step in mankind's ultimate colonization of the galaxy. The government fed my family all that baloney as well, back when they recruited my parents. And I admit, I completely fell for it. We all did. The recruiters made everything sound so amazing. Moonbase Alpha would have all the comforts of Earth, and more. We'd go down in history as one of the first families to live in space. We'd be the newest breed of pioneers, pushing the limits of human achievement. Like I said, garbage. Living in Moonbase Alpha is like living in a giant tin can built by government contractors. It's as comfortable as an oil refinery. You can't go outside, the food is horrible, it's always cold, and the toilets might as well be medieval torture devices. Ever notice how in all the science fiction movies and TV shows you've ever seen, Star Wars and Battlestar Galactica and all 142 versions of Star Trek, no one ever goes to the bathroom? That's not because in the future everyone has figured out how to metabolize their own feces. It's because going to the bathroom in space is a complete pain in the butt. Literally. At least the moon-based toilet is better than the one on the spaceship we took here. In zero gravity, you have to take extreme precautions to ensure that whatever comes out of your body doesn't fly up into your face. There's an old saying in zero-G space travel. If you ever see a piece of chocolate floating around the cabin, don't eat it. It's probably not chocolate. However, using the toilet on Moonbase Alpha is no picnic. If I'd known how exceptionally complicated and disgusting it would be, I never would have agreed to leave Earth. It was because of one of those evil toilets that I wound up involved in far more trouble and danger than I ever could have imagined. Now, before you get the idea that I'm some whiny, ungrateful kid who just likes to complain and wouldn't be happy anywhere, I'm not. Before my family made the awful decision to come live on the moon, I was happy as any kid you've ever met. Happier, maybe. We lived on the big island of Hawaii, which was awesome. Mom worked at the W.M. Keck Observatory, which runs the telescopes on the peak of Mauna Kea. Although the scopes are 13,000 feet up, they're managed remotely from the town of Waimea, which meant we could live down by the beach. So my childhood was pretty idyllic. I had lots of friends, I did well in school, and played on every sports team. I surfed every weekend, and when I did, there were usually dolphins in the waves with me. Then the government came calling. See, my parents have a very unique set of skills. Mom is a lunar geologist who wrote some landmark papers about the moon and the consistency of its mantle and core. Dad is a mining engineer with a specialty in environmentally sound mineral extraction. And one of the major reasons for the moon base is to explore the possibility of mining precious metals there. Separately, Mom and Dad would each have been solid candidates for Moon Base Alpha. Together, they were an impossible combination to beat. Space is limited on the moon. With them, NASA got two scientists without having to send two separate families. So they wanted my folks badly. We got the full court press. Politicians called us. The chairman of NASA came to visit. We were all flown to Washington, D.C., first class for lunch with the vice president. And every last one of them lied to our faces about how great it would be to live on the moon. They made it sound like MBA was going to be incredible. Like our lives there would be nonstop thrills and amazement. Imagine hearing that you've just won a free 3-year stay in the most luxurious hotel in the most insane location imaginable. Oh, and you get to be famous too. Not flash-in-the-pan, one-hit-wonder, reality TV famous. Have kids learn about you in school 100 years from now famous. We were going to be lumped in with the greatest explorers of all time. Maybe even score our own chapter in the history books. Columbus, Magellan, Neil Armstrong, the Harris-Gibson family of Moon Base Alpha. It all sounded too good to pass up, so we said yes. We spent the next year training, but then you know that. All the families who were headed for MBA became celebrities right off the bat. NASA tried to get everyone to refer to us as Lunarnauts, but the public ended up calling us Moonies instead. The whole world watched all our preparations for life on the moon, our multiple aborted launch attempts, and finally, our successful blast-off into space, and our triumphant arrival at our new home. And now that we're on the moon, millions of people are still following our lives via webcams and comlinks and beam feeds. And yet, despite all that, you Earthlings never get to see the whole story. Instead, you see the edited and sanitized version. There's too much at stake to allow anything else through. We Moonies are barred from broadcasting, texting, or transmitting anything to the public that might be detrimental to the success of Moon Base Alpha. And if we try, NASA has sensors who will delete it before it goes public. We can't complain about the toilets or the food or the malfunctioning equipment. We can't mention that anything has ever gone wrong. We have to constantly present a positive face to the public, even when there is nothing to be positive about. Which is why no one on Earth has ever heard about the murder. I only got involved because I had to use the space toilet at 2:15 in the morning. On the moon, this is a major endeavor, because we don't have a toilet in our private living quarters. Something else the government neglected to mention when talking up the moon base. Space toilets cost more than $30 million apiece, so instead of springing for one for each family, the moon base designers only bought 6 and placed them all in the communal bathrooms, 3 for the girls and 3 for the guys. The living quarters are all in one section of the base, but the geniuses who designed MBA put the bathrooms on the opposite side. The logical explanation for this was that the bathrooms would be closer to the work and dining areas, where we, in theory, would spend most of our awake time. Unfortunately, this means that when the urge to purge strikes in the middle of the night, you have to get dressed, leave your quarters, cross the base, use the complicated toilet, and then head back again. It can take 15 minutes or more if the toilet jams, which happens far more often than anyone predicted. Everyone at MBA loathes the entire process. Sometimes I can resist the call of nature and go back to sleep, but on that night, I knew it was useless. I'd had chicken parmesan for dinner. Sort of. Like all our meals, it was a shrink-wrapped block of pre-cooked food that had been irradiated, thermostabilized, dehydrated, and compacted, which meant it didn't taste anything like chicken parm back home. In fairness, a few space foods are actually pretty good. Shrimp cocktail and chocolate pudding, for example. But for the most part, they all taste like wet sawdust. Some of the other moon kids and I once did a blind taste test of three theoretically different space foods: beef stroganoff, blueberry pancakes, and chicken tikka masala. No one was able to tell the difference. While almost everything tastes the same going in, though, it all has drastically different effects on my digestive tract. Chicken parm is the worst. It had sent me racing to the John in the middle of the night twice before, so I had avoided it like the plague ever since. But on that night, I screwed up. All the meals don't merely taste alike, they also look alike. Once you've irradiated, thermostabilized, dehydrated, and compacted a meal, it doesn't look like food anymore. It looks like toy blocks. For this reason, the meals all have identification stickers to tell them apart. But the stickers often come off, and sometimes things just get labeled wrong. I had rehydrated what I thought was beef teriyaki for dinner, but due to the blandness, I was halfway through it before I realized my mistake. By then it was too late. I chucked the remnants in the trash compactor, a flagrant violation of the moon base's food conservation directives, and hoped for the best. Instead, I found myself running for the toilets at 2:15. My bowels were rumbling so loudly I was surprised they didn't wake everyone else at MBA. Actually, what I really did was bound for the toilets. The moon's gravity is only 1/6 that of Earth's. Zero gravity, which we experienced on the spaceship, could be fun. But 1/6 gravity is disorienting. For the first few days at MBA, everyone essentially had to learn how to walk again, and spent a lot of time crashing into walls. We eventually got the hang of it, though we still made mistakes at times. I covered a dozen feet with each leap as I hurried through the base, doing my best not to wipe out en route. At first glance, the men's bathroom looks like any normal communal bathroom on Earth. Tiled floor, three stalls, even a bit of graffiti on the walls. For a good time, call Princess Leia. However, there are no sinks, and no urinals. And the toilets look as though some sadistic plumber made it a vacuum cleaner with an octopus. The big problem with going to the bathroom on the moon is the scarcity of water. NASA found some ice near the North Pole, but it's difficult to extract, and there isn't much of it, which means every last drop of H2O we have is incredibly precious. Therefore, you don't flush your poop at MBA. Instead, you essentially do your business in a plastic bag, which is then hermetically sealed, dehydrated, and sucked into a composter. As for pee, you have to use a suction hose, which whisks everything away to a processor that filters out the impurities and sends the rest back into the main reservoir tank. Yes, we drink our own urine in space. They left that out of Star Trek, too. The sitting on the toilet part of the process usually takes about 5 minutes, but thanks to the chicken parm, I was there for the long haul that night. Thankfully, there was a slim-screen monitor on the inside of the stall door, so I could catch up on the latest news from Earth. In Game 2 of the World Series, the Charlotte Gladiators had beaten the Vegas Mustangs 6-3. Once I was done, I hit the evacuate button. To my dismay, the toilet jammed. It made a loud gagging noise, like a cat with a hairball. Then a message on the slim screen informed me that the separator had failed and wouldn't evacuate my poop until it was replaced. Unfortunately, I had no idea what a separator was. "Help," I said. "How may I be of assistance?" the base computer asked, speaking through the slim screen. The base computer always speaks in an attractive female voice. That's one thing the movies got right. Although I think the computer might have been programmed with a female voice because the movies had conditioned us to expect one. Most of the time, it's rather soothing. But when you're a 12-year-old boy on the toilet with your pants around your ankles, a sexy female voice can be a bit unnerving. "How do I replace the separator on the toilet?" I asked, and then thought to add, "Quickly." "I would be delighted to process your request," the computer replied. A second later, instructions appeared on the screen. Thankfully, they weren't too complicated, and there were several spare separators stored in a bin above the toilet. Replacing it still wasn't easy, though. It took another 15 minutes, which was why I was still in the bathroom when Dr. Holtz walked in. Ronald Holtz was one of the most brilliant men I'd ever met. He was an expert in low-gravity human physiology, essentially how the body holds up in space, and was his own best guinea pig. He had done 3 extended tours on the International Space Station, and thus had spent more time in space than virtually anyone alive. He was now almost 70, though he was in better shape than most men half his age. Plus, everyone liked him. He was always cheerful and friendly, and he knew thousands of jokes. When the time had come to select a physician for the base, there hadn't been any other choice. I was almost done replacing the separator when I heard Dr. Holtz enter. I knew it was him because he was humming. Dr. Holtz hummed whenever he was in a good mood. He was doing an upbeat tune that night, one my parents liked by some old-time singer named Lady Gaga. He didn't have any idea I was there, and I didn't try to tell him. I liked Dr. Holtz a lot, but I didn't want to startle him, and I didn't want to reveal that I'd busted the toilet. I listened to him enter the first stall, pee, evacuate it, and sanitize his hands, humming the whole time. He was walking out when I heard him stop suddenly. "Hey," he said, as though he was greeting someone. I hadn't heard anyone else enter, so I assumed Dr. Holtz had just answered a phone call. He didn't seem very surprised to be doing this at 2:30 in the morning, so I figured he'd been expecting the call. I felt guilty eavesdropping, but I also didn't want to burst out of the stall and suddenly reveal my presence. I couldn't think of a third option, so I stayed put and listened. "Yes," Dr. Holtz said, "I think the time has come to reveal the truth." The other person must have asked why. "Because I don't see any point in keeping it a secret anymore," Dr. Holtz replied. "It's too important. I know you have reservations, but I assure you, this is for the best." There was a pause while he listened to the other person talking. The space toilet chose this moment to belch some gas that had built up in the system. Luckily, it wasn't loud, and Dr. Holtz was too distracted to notice. However, since I was perched right over the bowl, the gust of space sewage fumes hit me full on. It was like having an elephant break wind in my face. I almost heaved up the rest of my chicken parm. "No, I don't think so," Dr. Holtz said, out in the bathroom. "This could be the most important discovery in all of human history. I've kept it under wraps for far longer than I expected, as is. People need to know." Another pause. "Well, no, I can't tell everyone," Holtz said. "Not yet. I don't have the authority to inform the general public. But NASA should know about this, and the government, and the National Institute of Science. There are far better scientists than I who ought to be privy to this." Another pause. While I was fascinated by what Dr. Holtz was saying, wondering what he could possibly be talking about, I was also desperately trying to control my queasy stomach. The nausea was passing, but it was taking its time. If the toilet released any more gas, I'd puke for sure. When Dr. Holtz spoke again, he sounded thrilled, giddy with excitement. "Then you agree? That's fantastic. I promise you won't regret this. Everything's going to be fine. Better than fine. It's going to be wonderful." The other person evidently asked when the news was going to be revealed. "First thing in the morning," Dr. Holtz replied. "I'd wake everyone here and tell them now if I could. We've waited long enough." A final pause. "All right, let's say breakfast then. 7 o'clock. Tomorrow we're going to make history." Dr. Holtz then broke into laughter. Deliriously happy, uncontrolled laughter. Although I'd found his entire conversation intriguing, this was the most startling thing of all. I'd never heard Dr. Holtz laugh like that before. In fact, I'd never heard anyone laugh like that before. It was like he'd just snorted a whole tank of laughing gas. I listened to it fade away as Dr. Holtz left the bathroom and headed back toward the living quarters. My stomach was feeling better, so I thought about running after Dr. Holtz and asking what was up, but I had my hands full with the toilet repairs. In retrospect, I wish I'd said to heck with the toilet, because Dr. Holtz didn't end up revealing his amazing news to anyone the next morning after all. Instead, at 5:30 a.m., in a direct violation of official Moonbase Alpha rules, he made an unauthorized trip through the airlock onto the surface of the moon. 2 minutes later, he was dead. Excerpt from the official residence guide to Moonbase Alpha, Copyright 2040 by National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Lodging. Each individual family at Moonbase Alpha has its own separate residence, which has been designed to provide extreme comfort and maximum living space. In fact, if you have come to MBA from New York City or Beijing, you may even find your residence surprisingly large compared to what you're used to. All units are equipped with multiple slim screens, enough for the whole family, direct comlink connections to Earth, ample storage space, and relaxing sleeping quarters. And with Slim Screen's Magic Portal technology, your private view can be personalized to any of 3 million Earth locations, allowing you a reminder of home or a taste of adventure. Chapter 2. Red Alert. Lunar Day 188. Morning. I didn't hear about Dr. Holtz's death until well after it happened. I hadn't been able to go back to sleep after overhearing his conversation in the bathroom. This was partly because I was excited to learn what he'd discovered, but mostly because our lunar sleeping quarters are horrible. Sleeping in low gravity is difficult to begin with. It's been a major problem with human spaceflight since day one. However, the idiots who designed MBA worked overtime to make the problem even worse. Due to space and weight considerations, no beds were brought to the moon. Instead, we all sleep on air mattresses that were specifically designed for minimum weight rather than comfort. They're stiff, they smell like burning tires, and they often leak. So it's common to wake up in the middle of the night to find yourself on the hard floor surrounded by deflated rubber. In addition, it's always daytime at Moonbase Alpha. All our power comes from the sun, generated by two massive arrays of solar panels, so MBA is situated near the moon's north pole, where the sun never sets. Anywhere else on the moon, we would have had 354 hours of night at a time, followed by 354 hours of day. To stay sane, all moonies are directed to follow a 24-hour Earth day, synced to the USA's central time zone via Mission Control in Houston, Texas. But I've had a hard time adapting to life without regular phases of night and day. Finally, we don't have bedrooms. Space is too valuable at MBA for those. Instead, we all sleep in personal sleep pods, which are claustrophobically small chambers built into the wall of our one-room apartment. Each has a sliding door so you can close yourself inside, but no one uses it because that makes the claustrophobia even worse. The sleep pods are stacked two by two like bunk beds, so I have to climb into mine. It's more like a tomb than a bedroom. With all of that, it was hard enough to sleep on a normal night, let alone when I knew one of the most important discoveries in human history was about to be revealed. I tossed and turned for hours, then finally gave up and dragged myself from bed at 6 a.m., figuring I could at least check the slim screen for the latest news from Earth. However, as I clambered out of my pod, my 6-year-old sister, Violet, popped her head out of hers.
"Morning, Dash," she chirped. "Is it breakfast time?"
"Not quite yet," I whispered, trying not to wake our parents. "Go back to sleep."
"I hope there's bacon this morning," she said, ignoring me. "Do you think there's bacon?"
"No," I sighed. "There's never been bacon here, and as far as I know, there never will be." Violet frowned for a split second, then returned to her usual perky self.
"Okay, I guess I'll have waffles then."
She scrambled out of her pod and drifted down to the floor next to me. On Earth, Violet barely weighed 40 pounds. In the moon's weak gravity, she might as well have been a leaf. She was wearing bright pink Hello Kitty pajamas, and her dark hair was sticking out every which way, making her look like Thing One from the Cat in the Hat.
"Is the rocket here yet?"
I turned to her, surprised. In my excitement about Dr. Holtz, I'd completely forgotten that a rocket was due that day, bringing new moonies and supplies. The rockets only come every few weeks, which makes their arrivals one of the rare breaks from the dull routine of lunar life.
"No, it's not due for another few hours if it doesn't get delayed." "Oh, maybe they'll have bacon."
"I wouldn't get your hopes up."
"Too late. They're up. Want to play chess?"
"You don't know how to play chess."
"I know what all the pieces do."
"That's not the same thing," I said.
"Did someone mention chess?"
My mother slipped out of her own sleep pod. In the one next to hers, I caught a glimpse of Dad, who groaned at the early hour and yanked the covers back over his head. Obviously, Violet's refusal to whisper had woken both of them, although Mom, as usual, did her best not to show any annoyance.
"I've got time for a little chess before breakfast," she said, tousling Violet's hair.
The two of them look so much alike, with their frizzy hair, dark skin, and green eyes, the people often teasingly ask if Mom just cloned herself. Mom looked to me.
Unless you want to play something too, then I could pick a game for all three of us.
Ooh, like Monopoly? Violet exclaimed. We can play the Moonbase Alpha version.
No thanks, I said.
You sure? Mom asked.
Definitely. I was too keyed up to spend the next few hours playing a game, and I certainly wasn't about to play one that took place at Moonbase Alpha. I felt trapped there enough as it was.
Your loss, Mom chided. Then she turned to the slim screen. Computer, chess, please.
Although computers have been able to control everything in homes on Earth for years, Mom and Dad always hated the idea. They never installed a control system back in Hawaii, but at MBA, the base computer is hardwired into every room, eternally ready to do anything we ask. Fortunately, we can adjust its personality in our private quarters, so Mom and Dad selected the funniest voice they could find, an outrageous, high-pitched German accent.
It would be my pleasure, the computer squealed. What version of chess do you desire?
Mom stifled a laugh.
Surprise us, she said.
I will do my best, mein Frau.
On our only table, the slim screen surface shifted from the standard simulated marble screensaver to a three-dimensional holographic chess game. The computer had selected an extremely ornate version, with pieces that looked like they'd been molded from pure gold and silver and studded with precious gems.
Ooh, Violet gasped. Can you make my pieces pink? I'm afraid I don't have the ability to emit odors, the computer replied. Therefore, I cannot make them stink.
Not stink, Mom snapped. Pink. Can you make her pieces pink?
The computer makes this sort of mistake a lot. Despite billions of dollars in research and development, no tech company has perfected voice recognition software yet. Even the most state-of-the-art systems screw up. There's a rumor that World War III almost started when the computer in charge of the North American nuclear missile system misinterpreted a commander saying, "I hate syrup," as "annihilate Europe."
I'm terribly sorry for the mistake, Fräulein,
our computer replied.
I will correct this right away.
All the golden chess pieces instantly became neon pink. Violet clapped her hands with delight and sat at the table. Like the beds, all our chairs at MBA are inflatable. Uncomfortable, unwieldy cubes of cheap, squeaky rubber. Whenever you sit on one, it sounds as though you just passed gas. Mom pulled up an inflate-a-cube across from Violet.
All right, Pumpkin, you go first.
Just so you know, chess isn't Mom's standard pastime. Usually when people hear my parents are scientists, they assume they're awkward, unathletic nerds whose idea of fun is doing long division. That drives me nuts. My parents are the least nerdy people you've ever met. Mom swam competitively in college and competed in triathlons up until we left Earth. Dad is a rugged outdoorsman. He's summited dozens of mountains and once free-climbed El Capitan in Yosemite in a day. They met on a Class 5 rafting trip down the Snake River. But more important, my parents aren't unusual. I've met hundreds of scientists, and most of them are as athletic and adventurous as my parents. I'm not sure how the whole idea that scientists are nerds ever got started. On Moonbase Alpha, the residents aren't merely brilliant, they're also incredibly physically fit. The NBA gym at peak hours looks more like the locker room of a pro soccer team. Unable to focus on the chess game, I turned to the main slim screen in our room. This one is enormous, taking up an entire wall. We don't have a window. Almost no one at MBA does, as windows are insanely expensive to deliver and install in space. So we use the screensaver to give ourselves a view. It was currently displaying Hapuna Beach on the big island at sunrise, waves lapping on the sand. Frankly, I prefer this to a window. We can project anything we want, while the surface of the moon is dull and gray and, since there's no atmosphere, never changes. Computer, bring up the home page on the big screen, I said.
Ja, mein Herr.
Hapuna Beach vanished and the MBA homepage took its place. I scanned it quickly, hoping to see that Dr. Holtz had called an important meeting for all residents, but there was nothing. In fact, the page hadn't even been updated recently. The previous night's Lunar Book Club meeting was still listed as the next upcoming event in the calendar. I couldn't wait in the room any longer. It was feeling even smaller than usual to me. Although Dr. Holtz had said he wouldn't be revealing his discovery until 7 o'clock, I figured he might be too excited to sit tight as well. Maybe he was already down in the communal kitchen, holding court.
I went to our bureau to grab some clothes.
Going out already? Mom asked. What's the hurry?
I'm hungry, I said.
You didn't even check the World Series scores.
Mom sounded slightly suspicious.
I checked them in the middle of the night, I said.
Charlotte beat Vegas 6-3.
Dad groaned from his sleep pod. You're kidding.
No, William Higgins hit a grand slam in the eighth off Jed Bynum.
What were you doing up in the middle of the night? Mom asked.
Bathroom. Revenge of the chicken parmesan.
It didn't take long for me to pick out clothes. Since the moon base is kept sterile, our clothes don't get very dirty, which is good as we have limited storage space and only one laundry machine at MBA.
Luckily, even if you work out hard, your clothes don't end up smelly, as it's the dirt and grime mixing with your sweat that makes the stink on Earth. Each pair of clothes can be worn multiple times before needing a wash, so we Moonies brought only 10 outfits each for our 3-year stay. This was fine with me, as I had basically worn a t-shirt and shorts every day back on Earth, though some Moonies found life with only 10 outfits as awful as I found life without decent food. I pulled on my Waimea Middle School surf team tee and yanked board shorts over the boxers I'd slept in. As I strapped on my smartwatch, I noticed a message on its tiny video screen. I'd missed a call from Riley Bach, my best friend back on Earth, the night before. I texted Riley that I'd call her later. She was probably still asleep. It was 1 a.m. in Hawaii. And besides, there was too much else to focus on that morning. I slipped into my sneakers and headed for the door. Violet abandoned her chess game and ran after me.
I'm hungry, too. I want waffles. Waffles, waffles, waffles.
Dash, can you wait for your sister to get ready? Mom asked.
No.
I didn't even slow down on my way out.
It always takes her 15 minutes to get dressed. I could eat and be back by then.
I don't need to get dressed, Violet announced. I'll just wear my pajamas.
I thought you wanted to play chess, I said.
I want waffles more.
We don't have real waffles on the moon, of course. We only have reconstituted waffle-flavored substance. It tastes like coagulated maple syrup, but Violet loves it. She's the only one at MBA who eats it. I grabbed the doorknob, ready to walk out anyhow.
Dash, wait for your sister, Mom ordered.
I stopped, knowing better than to disobey my mother. The last thing I needed was to be sent to my sleeping pod.
Let's move it, Squirt, I told Violet.
Let me get my slippers.
Violet scurried back to her pod, singing a song about waffles. Violet can make up a song about anything. She once performed practically an entire opera about clipping her toenails. Now she was happily crooning,
I love waffles, they're not awful, they taste so good.
A strange, urgent beeping suddenly filled the room. It sounded like a giant microwave announcing that the popcorn was done. It took me a moment to figure out it was coming from both slim screens at once. On the wall and the tabletop, the homepage and the chess game vanished and were replaced with a message in blinking red letters. Urgent communication for Dr. Rose Harris and Dr. Stephen Gibson. Log in to the secure portal immediately. I hadn't even known information could be delivered this way. I turned to my mother, who looked as surprised by it as I was. Violet danced around, excited by the noise, and added her own whooping to it. Dad still hadn't emerged from his sleeping pod. At the sound of the alarm, he had jammed his fingers in his ears and burrowed under the covers. Dad had never been a morning person.
Stephen, Mom called to him, you'd better take a look at this.
Dad stuck his head out of the pod and glanced at the big slim screen. He looked like a squirrel peeking out of its nest.
What the heck is that about? He grumbled.
Mom shrugged. She was already using the tabletop slim screen to log in to the portal. I was humming with excitement, figuring the emergency message had to do with Dr. Holtz's discovery. Maybe he hadn't been able to wait until 7 and had already revealed his amazing news to the top brass at MBA, who were now getting the word out. Or maybe he was calling a big meeting to share the news with everyone at once. I opened our door to see if anything was happening. There are 2 tiers of residences at Moonbase Alpha. Ours is on the 2nd floor, 1 down from the end. The door opens onto an iron catwalk. Catwalks are easier to ship and install than real floors. Over the railing I could see the 1st floor hallway below. No one was moving on either level, though the same urgent beeping was coming through the other residence doors. 2 residences to the right of mine, I could hear the muffled sounds of the Brahmaputra Marquez family groggily waking. Voices echoed through the base to my left, in the direction of the main airlock. There was an edge to them, as though the speakers were worried or panicked, but I couldn't hear what anyone was saying. Their words were all drowned out by my sister, who was still singing about breakfast foods at the top of her voice. Directly to my left, was the residence of the base commander, Nina Stack. It is the closest residence to the airlock. Nina's door hung open, which was unusual. Since there's so much common space at MBA, the residents take their privacy seriously. No one ever leaves their door open. Nina must have left in such a hurry she'd forgotten to shut it behind her. I started down the catwalk toward the airlock, but a horrified shriek from my mother stopped me in my tracks. I rushed back into our room. What's wrong? Mom had gone pale. She stared at the tabletop slim screen, eyes wide in astonishment. Dad stood behind her, equally stunned, having read the same message over her shoulder. Mom started to answer me, then noticed Violet. She looked to Dad, and something unspoken passed between them. Violet, Dad said, want to watch TV before you have your waffles? Now? Violet's face lit up. Even in the confines of MBA, my folks tried to limit our screen time. Offering TV before breakfast was like telling Violet she could have a pony. Can I watch Squirrel Force? Sure. Dad quickly clapped headphones over Violet's ears, ensuring that she wouldn't hear what my mother was about to say, then switched the big slim screen to TV mode. The emergency alert vanished and was replaced by animated squirrels battling evil land developers. Violet sat, riveted to it, ignoring us completely. If the base ever catches fire while Squirrel Force is on, Violet will probably roast alive rather than stop watching. Mom turned back to me. She was still so shocked. It took her a while to find her voice.
It's about Dr. Holtz. He's dead.
I'd been girding myself for bad news, but even this caught me off guard. It simply didn't seem possible. I was so dumbfounded, it felt kind of like my brain had popped inside my head, leaving nothing but air.
How?
I managed to ask. Dad put an arm around my shoulders. He went out the airlock this morning, alone. I turned to him, almost as startled by this as by Dr. Holtz's death. There are strict rules against anyone ever going out onto the lunar surface alone.
Why?
Mom wiped tears from her eyes.
We don't know. The report doesn't say.
Anyhow, Dad went on, it seems he didn't put on his spacesuit properly, and... He trailed off, not wanting to finish the thought. I knew how it would end anyhow. Spacesuits are almost impossible to put on properly by yourself. And if you make a mistake, the air can leak out. If that happens, there isn't any oxygen on the surface of the moon. Without oxygen, the human body can only survive 2 minutes at most, which is exactly why solo moonwalks are forbidden. I shook my head. This doesn't make sense. Dr. Holtz would never do anything that risky.
He did.
Mom placed a hand on mine. I know this is hard to process. I'm as surprised as you are. We all have questions, and it may be a while before we get answers.
Where's Dr. Holtz now? I asked.
Well, they're still bringing him back inside, Dad told me. I snapped to my feet and bolted back out the door, racing toward the airlock. Mom and Dad called after me, but I didn't listen. I wasn't sure why, but I desperately wanted to see Dr. Holtz's body for myself. I ran past Nina Stack's open door. Ahead, the catwalk banked left around a corner, where a set of stairs descended into the staging area by the airlock. As I reached the corner, however, Nina came around it. I slammed right into her. If I'd run into almost anyone else at MBA like that, I probably would have bowled them down the stairs. But running into Nina was like hitting an oak tree. She's the toughest woman I've ever met in my life, maybe even the toughest person. She was in the Marines before joining NASA and has kept up her physical training ever since. She doesn't look that tough. In fact, she looks kind of dainty, like a lot of my friends' moms back in Hawaii. But I'd pity anyone who challenged her to a fight. Nina can mop the floor with anyone, and she has an advanced degree in rocket science to boot. I bounced off her and went down on my butt. Sorry, I mumbled, then tried to slip past her. Nina blocked my path. Go back to your residence, Dash. It wasn't a request. It was an order. If Nina was upset about Dr. Holtz, it didn't show, but I wouldn't have expected that anyhow. I've seen moon rocks that express more emotion than Nina. She's so robotic, the Mooney kids call her Nina the Machina behind her back. I have to use the bathroom, I lied. Nina didn't buy it for a second. There's nothing to see, she told me. Which was also a lie, of course. I managed to catch a glimpse of the airlock over her shoulder. There was plenty to see. Nina hooked her hands under my arms, hoisted me off the floor, and forcibly carried me 10 steps back toward my apartment. Then she set me down and got in my face.
This isn't a game, Dashiell. Go home for now. You'll be able to leave soon.
When?
When I say so.
Nina pointed toward my door. I looked back to see both my parents standing there, waiting for me. I obediently retreated. Fact was, I'd already seen everything I needed to. The brief glimpse I'd gotten was more than enough. Two Moonies had been emerging from the airlock with Dr. Holtz, carrying him back inside, one holding his heels, the other his arms. Others had been crowded around them. I hadn't even noticed who any of them were. I was too focused on Dr. Holtz. They'd taken him out of his spacesuit in the airlock so I could see his face. The color had already drained from him. He was obviously dead. My parents ushered me back into our residence, seeming very concerned about me. I probably looked terrible after seeing Dr. Holtz. Certainly felt terrible. Dad shut the door. Mom steered me to an inflatacube. My sister was still watching TV with the headphones clapped over her ears, singing the Squirrel Force theme song at full volume, unaware that anything bad had happened.
"This is all wrong," I said.
Dad knelt beside me and put his arm around my shoulders. "I know, pal. It seems wrong to us, too." I shook my head.
"That's not what I meant. I don't think this was an accident."
Mom and Dad shared a slightly concerned look. Neither seemed sure what to say.
"You mean you think he did this on purpose?" Mom asked.
"No," I said, "not at all. I overheard Dr. Holtz in the bathroom last night. He was talking to someone about a discovery he'd made. A discovery he was going to reveal to all of us this morning. He was so excited about it. I've never heard anyone so happy. He couldn't wait to tell everyone. So why would he go outside, alone, this morning without checking to make sure his suit was on right? That doesn't make any sense."
Once again, Mom and Dad shared a look. This one was considerably more concerned, although I couldn't tell whether they were worried about me or about something else.
"Dash," Dad said gravely, "are you saying you think Dr. Holtz was murdered?"
"Yes," I told him. "That's exactly what I'm saying."
Excerpt from the Official Residence Guide to Moonbase Alpha, copyright 2040 by National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Education. For the benefit of families with children living at MBA, school will take place Monday through Friday, just as on Earth. Age-specific classes will be conducted via Comlink, with terrestrial instructors to provide the highest quality education possible. In fact, your children will probably receive an even better education on the moon than they did on Earth. NASA has recruited the finest, most effective teachers to lead classes, and your children's education will regularly be supplemented with lectures by NASA specialists in dozens of different fields, ranging from mathematics to biology to engineering. Since your children will be living on the moon, they'll be at the forefront of scientific research, so there's a chance they might even learn some groundbreaking information before anyone on Earth does.
Chapter 3. Bloodthirsty Gelatin. Lunar Day 188. Breakfast Time. School was canceled because of the crisis. Back on Earth, I would have been thrilled for a sudden day off. But on the moon, a day without school is even worse than a day with it. This isn't because I really love school. I don't. It's because at MBA there's nothing else to do. I couldn't use my newfound freedom to go surfing or mountain biking. Instead, I was cooped up in the same place I always was, but now without anything to occupy my time, which placed me in the bizarre situation of begging my parents to let me attend school.
"Please," I pleaded. "I don't have to go all day, only a few hours."
"I'm sorry," Dad said. "Nina gave a direct order."
"Come on, can't I take just one class?"
"No. You're not going to school today, and that's final."
"My teachers all work out of their homes," I argued, "and I'm not doing anything, so why can't I just comlink them and take my classes?"
"Nina wants all links left open for communication with NASA," Mom replied. My whole family was now in the mess hall having breakfast. Or rather, Violet was having breakfast. The rest of us were still too shaken up. I had tried to eat a rehydrated cinnamon bun, which is one of the best space foods we have, but my stomach was so jumpy I'd only managed a few bites. Many of our fellow Moonies seemed to be having the same problem. Most everyone was passing on the solids and simply drinking their reclaimed urine coffees. Violet, however, was happily scarfing down reconstituted waffles. Mom and Dad were letting her listen to music so she wouldn't notice what else was going on. She had her earbuds in and was happily rocking out to her favorite band,
a retro ska dance group called Coronal Mass Ejection. Between the waffles, the music, and the fact that school had been canceled, it might as well have been Christmas for Violet. "There are 256 comlinks," I told my parents. "That's more than 10 for every person here. What could Nina possibly need all of them for?"
"I think it's standard emergency procedure," Dad said.
"I know," I countered, "but the emergency procedures were designed for something like an asteroid strike or an oxygen leak, weren't they? Technically, this isn't even an emergency anymore. It's not like Dr. Holtz can get more dead."
My mother glanced at Violet to see if she'd overheard this, but Violet had her earbuds firmly jammed in her ears. Mom then fixed me with a hard stare.
"I don't think that sort of talk is appropriate."
"Sorry," I said. "It's just that without the links, I can't talk to my friends on Earth, or download a book, or watch a movie."
"It's only temporary." Dad looked at the other tables to make sure no one was within eavesdropping range, then lowered his voice. "Things are going to be a little unsettled here for a bit. No one ever expected Dr. Holtz to have an accident like this."
"That's because it wasn't an accident," I said under my breath. "Someone forced him to walk out that airlock with his suit on wrong."
Mom sighed. "Dashiell, we've already discussed this. You have no proof of that."
"Dr. Holtz would never have gone out the airlock without a partner," I protested. "He was always warning us that it's almost impossible to put a spacesuit on right by yourself. He was the one who came up with the buddy system for going out on the surface in the first place."
"That doesn't mean it was a murder," Dad countered. "There are plenty of reasons he might have decided to ignore the rules. Maybe it had something to do with this big discovery of his. Maybe he had to get something off the lunar surface."
"And risk almost certain death?" I asked.
"No way. Dr. Holtz was the most cautious person I ever met. He wore a helmet to ride the stationary bike."
"Even the most cautious people make mistakes," Mom told me. "And furthermore, there doesn't appear to be any evidence of foul play."
"It's only been an hour," I muttered. "I'm sure some will turn up." Mom and Dad exchanged one of their concerned looks. They'd been doing this a great deal that morning, like they were far more worried about me than they were about Dr. Holtz. Dad said, "Dash, you're a smart kid. You're very mature and precocious for your age, and we love that about you. But sometimes that brain of yours works a little too hard to see patterns where there might not be any."
"Dealing with the death of someone close to you is always difficult," Mom added. "We all have our different mechanisms for confronting a tragedy like this."
"I'm not making this up,"
I snapped way too loud. Everyone in the mess turned toward us, so I had to lower my voice again.
"You didn't hear Dr. Holtz in the bathroom last night. If you had, you'd be just as sure as me that this wasn't an accident."
My parents recoiled from me. My outburst had caught them by surprise, but I think it convinced them that I wasn't merely having problems dealing.
"Well, if this was a murder," Dad said, "then you're right. Some evidence ought to turn up. But if none does..."
"I'll drop it,"
I finished.
"There's something else you should know about Dr. Holtz that's important," Mom began, but she didn't get to finish. Dr. Timothy Marquez was approaching our table.
Mom fell silent so he wouldn't overhear her.
"Dr. Marquez is the Moon Base Alpha psychiatrist. NASA is very concerned about our mental health. Living in an enclosed space far from Earth is a good recipe for going nuts, so we all have mandatory evaluation sessions once a week. Dr. Marquez is the only Moonie who was really famous before being selected to come to MBA. He wrote a best-selling self-help book called Turn That Frown Upside Down and appeared on tons of talk shows. Despite this, I've always found him a little weird. He has a lot of nervous tics and is a little too intense for me. He takes his job way too seriously and is always sticking his nose in everyone else's business, like he was doing right then."
"Is everything all right over here?"
he asked, obviously having overheard my outburst. He had a cup of coffee and was compulsively stirring it with a spoon. Dr. Marquez rarely ever actually drinks his coffee. He simply stirs it for hours at a time.
"Yes," Dad said dismissively, "everything's fine."
Dr. Marquez made a high-pitched giggle. He sounded like a monkey being tickled.
"Oh, I highly doubt that.
We have all just experienced a highly traumatic incident. In fact, we are still experiencing it. So I don't think that everything is fine at all. Not for you, not for me, not for any of us."
Dr. Marquez sat on the inflatacube beside me without being invited.
"So tell me, how are all of you really holding up?"
His arrival grabbed Violet's attention.
There's no school today, she shouted over her music, and I'm having waffles.
Oh. Dr. Marquez never seemed to know how to deal with Violet's effusive happiness.
That's nice.
We're doing as well as can be expected, Mom put in. How's your family, Timothy?
Oh, they've gone through the whole gamut of emotions.
Dr. Marquez picked a chunk of dehydrated fruit out of his teeth and flicked it away.
Shock, disbelief, grief, anger, you name it. He looked to me. Roddy's had a tough time himself. He's in the rec room right now. I'm sure he could use a friend to talk to.
That's a great idea, Mom said. Is it really? I asked, not so convinced. I think it'd be good for you to talk to someone your own age right now, Dad said. Besides, we still have to break the news to your sister, and it might be best if we did that on our own. He nodded to Violet, who had returned to obliviously devouring waffles and listening to her music. I nodded understanding and got up. Dr. Marquez didn't.
Perhaps I could be of some assistance with young Violet, he said to my parents. It might be nice to have a professional around to help cushion the emotional blow.
Thanks. That'd be very helpful, Mom said, although I wasn't sure if she meant it. When you live in an enclosed space with only 22 other people, you can't ever really afford to offend anyone. I went to the drink station, poured myself a cup of reclaimed water, and headed to the rec room. Although it would have been faster to go past the Moonbase gym, I looped around the long way instead. In truth, MBA isn't that big. It's only about the size of a soccer pitch. So the long way wasn't really all that long. But more important, it took me past the main airlock. MBA has a simple design. It consists of two octagons, one large and one small. The large octagon is the residential area. The apartments, gym, kitchen, and communal bathrooms line the outer wall, with the control center, greenhouse, and rec room in the center. The small octagon is the science pod, where experiments in biology, chemistry, geology, and astrophysics are conducted. The science pod is attached to the northwest corner of the main building from above. MBA looks like a large stop sign with a smaller one growing on it like a tumor. My route first took me between the science pod and the control center. Almost every adult on the base works in one or the other, so on most days they would have been hives of activity. Today, both were almost empty. Only Dr. Janke, one of the biologists, was in the science pod, absently fiddling with one of his experiments. He didn't appear to be working so much as trying to distract himself from Dr. Holtz's death. Nina was the only one in the control center. She was using the comlink and had her back to me. Mission Control in Houston was on the slim screen. A dozen men and women had gathered to talk to her, all with very grave expressions on their faces. I considered trying to eavesdrop, but Nina turned my way and gave me a hard stare that was basically an order to keep on moving, so that was exactly what I did. I passed the maintenance room and the operations center for the base robots, crossed through the staging area where all the spacesuits were stored, and finally came to the airlock. The whole journey had taken 26 seconds. The airlock is one of the rare spots at MBA with a window. Technically, there are two windows, as the airlock has two doors, an inner door and an outer door, with a 4-foot safety chamber between them. The view through the windows is narrow and obstructed, but then the area outside the airlock isn't much to look at anyhow. Since there's no atmosphere on the moon, the only thing that ever alters the landscape is us, and humans rarely alter a landscape for the better. What was once a pristine white blanket of moon dust has now been trampled by a million footprints and flattened by the treads of the moon rovers, which are housed in a garage near MBA. It's like when a fresh, beautiful snowfall gets ruined by boot prints and tire tracks, only instead of eventually melting away, it just stays in that ugly, polluted state forever. On the ruined lunar surface, it was impossible to pick out Dr. Holtz's footprints or pinpoint where he'd collapsed and died. All I knew was, without his spacesuit on right, he couldn't have gotten far. There's no oxygen outside. The farthest I can get holding my breath is about 50 feet. I've tested this indoors on multiple occasions, just in case of trouble. There were still some traces of moon dust on the staging area floor. At breakfast, I'd learned who had recovered Dr. Holtz's body. Daphne Merritt, our base roboticist, and Garth Grissen, who was in charge of maintenance. Normally, for sanitation reasons, there were extreme precautions to prevent tracking moon dust into the base, but it had probably been hard to follow them all when one of the three people coming back inside was dead. Despite being surrounded by megatons of moon dust, I'd never touched the stuff before. I'd been out on the lunar surface myself exactly once,
when passing from the rocket landing pad to MBA after arriving on the moon. It had taken 10 minutes, tops. Because I'm a kid, I'd never been allowed another chance to go outside. I knelt and dragged my fingers through the dust. It felt like slightly gritty powdered sugar. Moondust isn't really dust. It's mostly tiny shards of a strange kind of glass formed in the extreme heat of meteor impacts. It smelled faintly of gunpowder, reminding me of fireworks.
Did you drop something?
I spun around to find Garth Grissom behind me. Mr. Grissom is in his late 50s, which is older than most of the people at MBA, but running maintenance for everything on the base requires someone with a lot of knowledge and experience. He seemed nice enough, but he tended to keep to himself. Although I'd been living at the base with him for more than 6 months, we'd almost never spoken. No, I said, I was just, there's some moon dust on the floor.
Yeah, I'm about to take care of that.
Mr. Grissom held up a small vacuum. With all the excitement this morning, I haven't had a chance yet. I suddenly felt embarrassed. I wasn't telling you to clean it up, I said. I just noticed it and, well, I trailed off, not quite sure what else to say.
Mr. Grissom smiled warmly, signaling he hadn't been offended. It's all right, Dashiell. We're all trying to deal with Dr. Holtz in our own way.
I nodded agreement, then thought to ask, You went out and got him? Mr. Grissom's smile faded.
Yes? With Daphne?
Did anything seem strange about him?
Other than him being dead on the surface of the moon? The whole thing seemed strange. Strange and wrong.
Mr. Grissom shuddered at the memory. Was he... I began, but before I could get another word out, Mr. Grissom cut me off.
To be honest, I prefer to forget all about what it was like, and it's probably better for a kid like you not to know, so if you'll excuse me...
Mr. Grissom held up the vacuum again and pointed to the floor. Right, I said. Sorry. I turned to leave and caught sight of Nina in her office. She was glaring at me, apparently annoyed that I was still within range of her. I took a last glance out the airlock, then hurried off. Behind me I heard the whine of the vacuum as Mr. Grissom sucked up the moon dust. Like his father had told me, Rodrigo Roddy Marquez was in the rec room. This wasn't much of a surprise. Roddy was almost always in the rec room. That's where the best holographic interfaces are. As usual, Roddy was seated on an inflatacube playing a virtual reality game. His eyes were covered by thick black holo-goggles, and his hands were sheathed in sensor-gloves. Either he hadn't heard that Nina had ordered everyone to stay off the comlink, or, more likely, he'd decided to ignore her. Roddy was my best friend at MBA, although that really didn't mean much. He was the only other kid my age on the moon. Back on Earth, we probably wouldn't have been friends at all. Roddy is a decent guy, but our interests are completely different. He's what we called a VR at my old school, short for virtual resident, a kid who spends nearly all his time in the computer-generated world. I've never spent much time in virtual reality myself. We didn't even have a holographic interface at our house. Meanwhile, Roddy logged more than 10 hours a day online before he came to the moon. For that reason, he doesn't hate MBA nearly as much as I do. His life here is almost exactly the same as it was back on Earth. He spends as much time as possible jacked in and never goes outdoors. Roddy was so fixated on his game, he had no idea I'd entered the room. He was jerking about wildly, arms extended, his index fingers twitching like worms on a fishhook. That meant he was probably playing a war game, blasting away with virtual guns. I tapped him on the shoulder. Hey, Roddy, how you doing?
I'm in the middle of a raid here, he said curtly. Jack in if you want to talk.
I sighed. This is one of the problems with VRs. They find talking in the virtual world more comfortable than doing it face-to-face. Still, I didn't feel like waiting around for Roddy to finish his game. Knowing him, that could have taken days. There were plenty of holo-goggles and sensor-gloves stored on a rack on the wall. I slipped some on, sat on the inflatacube beside Roddy, and jacked into his interface. With a whoosh, the dull gray walls of the rec room vanished, and I suddenly found myself in one of the most startlingly beautiful landscapes I'd ever seen. I was standing in a meadow full of wildflowers by a pristine, blindingly blue lake, with verdant forest on one side and snow-capped mountains on the other. 6 separate waterfalls spilled into the lake, each more breathtaking than the last. Roddy had no doubt combed through thousands of potential earthscapes to find one this stunning, and then selected it to wage a war in. His enemies were some sort of gelatinous pink alien creatures. Although they all had guns, they didn't appear very menacing. Roddy had probably set the game controls to a beginner level, preferring easy victory to stiff competition. The aliens had stubby little flippers instead of hands, which meant they could barely even hold their weapons, let alone fire them. Meanwhile, Roddy was blowing them away with ease. Each time he hit one, it burst into a shower of pink goo, like someone had detonated a bowl of strawberry jello. Roddy had heavily modified his avatar as well. While the